Okay, so welcome to Dr. Harry's podcast number 5. I'm Julian Lasso, and this is my friend and colleague, Dr. David Hindmarsh.
That's me, yeah.
We're going to be discussing a number of articles culled from the BMJ. I think most of them are from the BMJ time, and the BJGP. Yeah. And we're going to start by discussing one entitled Crisis in the Supply of Medicines. It's about drug shortages. What's the reference for this one? The reference for this one is BMJ L5841. So this was in the October, one of the October editions of the BMJ. The context of this, as far as we're concerned, the reason that it kind of caught our eye is that, you know, there are increasing numbers of things going missing.
Yes. HRT in particular.
HRT. There was a thing about EpiPen, wasn't there?
Yes,
which is still
rumbling
on, and HRT, as you say.
Yes.
There were
various other things like nifedipine.
Ranitidine.
Ranitidine stopped making.
They suddenly sort of decided that got some contaminant in it, and then first of all, one manufacturer. First of all, it said. It's got this contaminant in it, but in such minute amounts that it doesn't make any difference.
No.
And then all of a sudden, one of the manufacturers went, well, we're not going to make it anymore. And then all forms of it were withdrawn within the space of about two or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But this kind of thing is happening, it seems to us that it's happening.
Two or 3 years, there's been lots of these. We can't get this anymore, or they're not making it.
And some of it may be down to our particular pharmacy and their head office and their suppliers.
Yes, yeah.
And we don't want to diss any particular pharmaceutical chain.
We wouldn't mention their name at all.
But it's Lloyd.
David Lloyd, right.
But part of it is obviously sort of a bit more deep-lying than that.
Yeah.
Like this thing about EpiPen and ranitidine, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority, the MHRA,
which
sends out notifications about, you know, problems with a batch of this or the manufacturing of that, and you've got to check to make sure whether or not you've got this particular product because there might be a problem with it.
Yeah.
Well, the numbers of those that are coming out seem to be ever increasing because there were 7 of them on Saturday when I was going through my emails.
Well, that does sound
and it used
lot.
To be at about like 1 every 2 weeks or something.
Yeah.
So that whole thing, the whole I mean, you get the impression that the entire pharmaceutical industry is basically falling to bits. But that's kind of a worm's eye impression.
Yeah.
And what this article in the BMJ says is something a bit different from that, really.
Yeah, well, they're saying that it is a global problem.
Mm.
And, 56 different kinds of medicines are no longer available in Australia, 5%. Not available in Belgium, 700 to 800 different kinds of tablets not available in Holland and France. So there's a lot, and there's 900 in the UK, so we're top of the league, really.
Well, that's fun. It's difficult to sort of... some of it's in percentages.
Yes, that's true.
And then when you look at the kind of figure of 900 for the UK...
Yeah, that could be 1%.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was another article, I think, in the BMJ that said that the HRT shortages applied to the UK and they didn't apply to other countries.
I think they do apply to other countries because they were saying there are other countries, I think the States in particular, are limiting their exporting of HRT tablets.
Right. Okay.
But that's also what we're doing now.
Right.
Well, you and me, obviously.
We've completely stopped exporting HRT tablets.
Yeah, I'm not doing it again. It's just not worth the hassle.
No. I'm putting all of those packets.
I don't.
and then post them out to people. It's ridiculous.
Falsify the expiry date. It's dreadful.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, enough said about that.
Yeah.
So, but they're also saying, you know, maybe in England, you know, in the UK, you're going to be trouble with getting hold of anti-epileptics as well. So there's some problems there.
So, I mean, this article was a bit of an eye-opener in a number of respects. One respect, as far as I was concerned, was that was that it kind of indicates that it's not just the UK, it is all over the place.
Yes, yeah.
But also, I think the second thing that struck me was this business of... What's it called? Like secondary exporting or something?
Yes,
where you
that's
import
right.
them.
Yes,
and it seems to happen particularly in Europe, as far as I can make out. Yes. So you import them into the UK, let's say.
That's right. Or parallel exports. That's
parallel exports, and then you re-export them to another country because it turns out that you can make some money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which so I had no idea that that was taking place at all.
No, so it's obviously big business, isn't it?
But then the third aspect of it that I hadn't really thought of was the fact that so much of the production of these pharmaceuticals has been farmed out to the Far East and or third world countries.
Yes, yes, that's right. And it's not. It's also the ingredients are coming from there as well.
Yeah,
a pinch of sugar and a teaspoon of salt.
Turmeric.
So you're right. I mean, it's China, India, US. China's the biggest one.
And of course, as we were saying earlier on today, with this is relevant to the coronavirus crisis because if China is, I mean, already there are large sections of the Chinese economy have been sort of put on hold. People don't want to import stuff from China.
No.
Borders are closing.
Yeah.
And as coronavirus goes romping around the world, it's that effect is likely to go into a lot of other countries, particularly in the third world.
Well, that's
you would
true.
Imagine.
Yes, but they're also saying in the article that the factory inspections and some of these companies that supply a lot of the ingredients and drugs are not as you might expect them to be.
So, in other words, production in the third world is probably cheaper,
because
the standards are a bit more lax than they would be if stuff was produced in Europe or in the UK.
Yeah. Anyway, there's a bit here about the Department of Health are giving money to pharmacies if they can't buy stuff because the tariff, something about the tariff.
Oh, yes.
Because of shortages. Or they can't meet, you know, get the drug tariff that they would get on them because of shortages. So somebody's happy.
So this relates to this kind of arcane system where there's a kind of a tariff price for something.
Yes.
And then there's a manufactured price for branded versions of the same article.
Yeah, yes.
And there's often a big difference between the two.
Yes.
And
they keep changing anyway.
And sometimes it's cheaper to prescribe it by brand name, and sometimes it's more expensive to prescribe it by brand name.
Yes.
And the pharmacies, what do they get paid? Do they get paid the sort of...
The NHS cost price, do they? I don't know.
I'm not sure. But that was the kind of the basis of this, where there are cases where the pharmacies can no longer get hold of the type or the version of the drug that would be best for them financially, and they're in danger of losing out.
Yeah, that's right.
And therefore, I suppose there's a danger of them not wanting to stock that particular drug at all, which is where the local pharmacy might sort of say, sorry, we haven't got this particular one.
That's right.
And it's something that's confined to that particular pharmacy, possibly.
Yeah, well, that's quite possible.
So there are all sorts of aspects to it that are really complicated. I mean, that whole system of having these different tariffs is a bit weird and wacky, really, isn't it?
Well, it is, it's an odd idea. But certainly when we've had these, you know, trade name changes, you know, in the past, they suddenly end up being changed to something else.
Yes, I mean, when we first came into general practice, the rule was prescribe everything generically.
Yes, that's
right. It's cheaper that way.
And also, everyone knows what the drug is, and instead of calling it something, botulose something or other toxic.
Botulos toxin.
Yes, that's right. Causal diseases.
You, you can understand how a drug with that brand name would become extremely popular.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I'll have a bottle of that.
I wouldn't be where I am today without my regular doses of botulose toxin. So we used to absolutely prescribe everything generically. Well, yeah. There was a big drive
that was supposedly good medicine in those days.
And then sort of in more recent years, it's been don't prescribe it as salbutamol, prescribe it as Ventolin, because Ventolin Evo here is cheaper than salbutamol. And then all of a sudden it will reverse back the other way again.
Yes.
And there are a number of... we're drifting off the point a little bit, but there are a number of exceptions to the usual rule, like, for example... the prescribing of lithium is supposed to be done by brand name.
Well, and some anti-epileptics as well.
Yes, because it's safer if you're on a specific formulation of that drug.
Bioavailability, don't they? Yeah.
And then there are ones that become cheaper if you prescribe them branded, as you say.
Yeah.
But then when you try to get that particular brand,
the
pharmacy says we can't get that particular brand, and you end up having to switch it back to generic again. Yeah. So the whole thing comes across as being a waste of time.
Yeah, but the other thing about this from the UK point of view is that 70% of UK medicines come across the channel. And of course we're not allowed to use the channel anymore.
No.
unless
you swim across the channel for comic relief.
Yeah.
So what we're going to have to do is get people swimming across the channel for comic relief to bring drugs with them.
That's a really good idea.
Balanced on their heads.
Yeah, so you get fit and you drown.
And you also look extremely funny.
Yeah, okay, well that's a good plan. And then there's apparently some government serious shortage protocols for short people.
Yes, I mean, Brexit comes into it as well, doesn't it? But again, going back to coronavirus, if people are going to start closing borders and making difficulties getting things from A to B, it's going to have all sorts of knock-on effects, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they're talking about express freight service and increased stock.
Yeah, stockpiles.
But the trouble is, if we all stockpile, then you're going to have lots of stockpiles and... you know, lots of places where you can't actually get anything. So it's a little bit, sort of feathering your own nest in a way.
Yes, I think there is something in there about them trying to stop this parallel exporting for certain important drugs.
Yes.
to make sure that if you've got a big stock of them in the country, it doesn't get sold to another country for the sake of a quick profit.
That is a sensible ethical view of things.
Yeah,
like everything in the NHS.
Yes.
Okay. Are we done with that one?
I think probably. Yes. Okay. It is getting very unpredictable what's available and what's not available.
Yes.
So, I mean, we've kind of touched on coronavirus.
Yes.
And this is the second article that we thought we'd have a look at is specifically to do with... measures for dealing with coronavirus.
Yeah.
And this is BMJ M621, and it's called Coronavirus Home Testing Pilot Launched in London to Cut Hospital Visits and Ambulance Use. this was to do with the way in which people were being tested in London to see if they got coronavirus or not.
Yes.
And because the existing protocol was that it should be done by ambulance.
Yeah.
I think it says in this article there was one particular day.
Yeah.
On which. The need for community testing became clear after 25 London ambulances had to be taken out of services in one afternoon. To be decontaminated. This is the problem, to decontaminate them, after carrying potential cases to hospital for testing.
And the decontamination took 8 hours.
Yeah.
So obviously the cleaner was very, very slow.
So they thought, well, what are we doing this for? Why don't we
do the home testing. So they changed it to like a telephone triage. Do you say triage or triage?
I say triage.
Do you?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if it's right or not.
Okay. I say potato, honestly.
Yeah.
They then decide with the triage or triage that you, is it okay to self-isolate at home?
Yeah.
Is it, or use PP, do they, the people visiting need to use personal protective equipment, which means healthcare professionals basically, and then they visit and test, is that right? Is
Yeah, so
that
it's as they've suggested that this could involve training district or practice
Yes.
nurses to do the testing, with the secondary care teams handling the rest.
Yes.
So, and in fact, that this has now become, and I don't know if this is a result of this pilot, but a similar arrangement has now been arrived at here in Kent,
Yes.
where community health. By
Yes.
which I take it we're talking about the practice nurses, although there may be some paramedics and people involved as well. But per community health and services and the CCAM services, which is
Yes.
our local ambulance service,
Yes.
are going to cooperate to organise the sort of home testing of patients who may be, who are
Yes.
suspected of having coronavirus. So it doesn't, so you don't, they don't have to go to hospital and get tested there.
No, well, that's very sensible. That's the last thing you want to
I mean, as you said
do.
this morning, whoever actually ends up having to do the testing, in a
Yes.
way, has drawn the short
Well,
straw.
absolutely, yes. And if you suddenly say to all the district nurses, you've got to do the testing, or somebody says that, then the likelihood is you haven't got much of a district nurse service anymore.
That this is assuming that the protective gear.
Yes.
I haven't got very much insight into what the protocol is here, but whether it says you've got to go and do home testing, but get completely suited and booted before you go out there. So you've got all the face mask and the
Well,
visor and the
yes. I mean,
gloves
it might be
and.
quite difficult to drive a car when you're wearing all that
Well,
stuff.
you don't drive there wearing
Oh, don't you? Oh, right.
it. No, you get dressed. When you went to see that guy with swine flu, you didn't drive there in
No,
all that
I put
gear.
all the stuff on in his porch, and
Yes.
then when I went into the house,
You were arrested.
yes.
The police had seen you from outside.
But I think what happens is I think the visits, if they're safe to be self-isolated, is within 24 hours, and they visit and test, but they also give advice about isolation and letting getting in touch with the right people if there is a deterioration, and then informing them of the test results. I'm not sure how long that takes. So they have this emergency number, and if it's positive, then they get admitted. So does everyone with a positive test get admitted? And if they say, well, I'm feeling much better now. Yeah, no, really, I am.
Well, I think probably at the moment,
Yes,
yes,
they
they
probably
do.
will.
Everybody with a positive test probably does get carted off to hospital. But whether they're going to continue doing that. So the bottom end of this article, it says, as of 13th of February, 9 people in the UK have been confirmed as infected with COVID-19. More than 2,500 people have been tested. Well,
Yes, so nine out of 2,500,
But today, 4th of March, The Guardian have just reported a jump in of 30 new cases, a more than 30% jump, taking the total, I think, to 85 in the whole of the UK.
Somebody said there was 35 the other day, so but you never know.
So it is, it's starting. So that's one thing about it. It's starting to progress in that sort of parabolic style that we saw in China. But I mean, what strikes me about this is that it's kind of, an example of how the people who are working at the actual coal face and on the ground sort of moderate and redesign the protocols that are handed down to them from on high, so that the Department of Health and Public Health say, you've got to do this. And the guys on the ground here have thought to themselves, now, wait a minute, we've just had 25 ambulances taken out of circulation for an entire day by virtue of,
Yes, unnecessary
yes, by virtue
visits.
of following the protocol without rethinking it a bit. And so, you really do need to have some flexibility in how these things are
Yeah,
applied,
that's true.
or otherwise they can have
It's
unforeseen
going to be
knock-on
unmanageable.
consequences,
Yes,
that
exactly.
just make life unmanageable.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, as far as the coronavirus kind of, you know, the whole sort of episode is concerned, the things, the questions that seems to me are still completely unanswered are how long are people still infectious for after they've got over coronavirus?
Yeah.
How long do you have, well, if you've been identified as having coronavirus, how long does it take you to get over it? And at what point do you stop being infectious? No, don't think anybody's ever said anything about
that. No, but, well, I suppose that...
Perhaps they don't know.
Well, it's probably similar to the flu, isn't it? I would guess it's the same sort of virus.
Yeah, and what's the rule with the flu then?
I've
and
no what idea. Point do you become... Okay. But usually, most viruses, you know, infectious for a relatively short time, aren't they?
Well, the bit with, you know, the bit with the cold is sort of you're infectious at the front end of it.
Yes.
When you're starting to feel all sort of feverish and burning sore throat and all that kind of business. Yeah. And then once you're actually full of snot, but you're not feverish anymore, you're probably not, you look hideous, but you're probably not all that infectious.
Yeah.
Whereas, so that's the rule.
Yeah. TB, for instance, it's infectious for quite a long time in some people.
But the other thing that there is a balancing point between, trying to control the virus by closing down various parts of society.
Yes, yeah.
There's a point, there must be a tipping point at which, you know, the sort of financial and social consequences of doing that outweigh the consequences of just letting coronavirus run its course.
Yes.
And it's,
yes.
I mean, and we don't really have a very clear idea of where what the worst case scenario is.
No.
If coronavirus just completely ran rampant, how many people would likely to be infected with it in the UK?
Yeah.
How many hospital admissions would that be likely to cause?
Yes.
How many deaths would be likely to?
Yes, yeah. But if you think about, you know, the Spanish flu, obviously that was long before my time, but, you know, that was horrendous, wasn't it?
Yes, well, it was supposed to have killed more people than the First World War.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, possibly it's not a lot worse than that. And it may be that some of that was people were not well nourished and things like that after the, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, that time. But
I think the main reason why they're so desperate to keep it under control is because they're worried that, because flu is very disruptive.
Yes, it is, from the health sort of services. Yes, especially secondary care.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So if coronavirus is X times worse than flu, and the hospital system really struggles to cope with the effects of flu, what effect is coronavirus going to have on the hospital system? And I think that's part of the reason.
Well, I think that is the big worry, isn't it? And, you know, even just a few years ago, there was an article looking at the sort of emergency measures in different countries for dealing with flu, and Sweden were very good, and France were very good.
Yes,
and I'm not sure about the UK.
It's not so good.
So, you know, it's an unknown, isn't it? That's the big issue.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't buy the big issue very much. Sports page isn't very good.
So that's probably
that'll do.
Yeah. That'll do for that one.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk next about this? Should we talk about the Amazon Alexa one?
Yeah, that's an interesting.
That's quite an interesting one because that's kind of another sort of another one where it's a little bit about the government going into partnership with big business to try to solve health problems.
Yes.
So, I mean, we were talking in one of the previous podcasts about the fact that Matt Hancock has apparently made, you know, NHS information available to Amazon.
Yes, yeah.
And we weren't sure at that stage, I don't think, what kind of information he was making available.
Yes.
But it appears that what he's basically doing is he's making sort of NHS advice available to Amazon so that the Alexa personal assessment assistant in people's homes.
So it's not personal medical information.
I don't think so. No, but I think the idea is that if somebody who's got Alexa in their home says, Alexa, I've got a bit of a sore throat and an earache.
Yes.
Should I go and see my doctor? Then Alexa will say, well, according to NHS Net or the 111, advice pages about sore throat and earache.
Yeah.
You probably don't need to see your doctor.
You could just
self-medicate and take paracetamol for a couple of days, and it'll probably clear up of its own accord.
But do you think it could be like any sort of triage or trial system where, it's going to have a low, level of, risk-taking? So it might say, better see the doctor about that in case you've got something serious in your throat.
Well, I suspect that if it does actually sort of follow the advice that's available
it's reiterating the advice.
Yes, from NHS web pages, it'll say the formula will be, this is the normal symptoms for a sore throat are blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It normally self-resolves within a few days.
Yeah.
If you're concerned or worried and it doesn't seem to be resolving itself within a few days, then consult your GP.
Yes. Yeah.
So in other words, it's kind of, don't just necessarily go straight to the GP away.
No.
You could probably just stay home and look after this with some paracetamol.
Yes, and it's probably no different than people looking up the advice on the internet.
Yeah. So the same sort of thing, basically.
But it actually talks to you.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. You had a look at the article and you were saying about the fact that one of the things you picked out was the way that people interact with one of these personal digital assistants.
Well, there were, yes, that's right. There was some trial done in Stoke-on-Trent.
Yeah.
And they found that it increased independence.
Right.
Nearly all of the recipients of the Alexa box or whatever you call it.
Yeah. I take it you haven't got one of these things in your house.
Well, no, but I've seen them
on the telly. Houses. Oh, have you really?
Yeah. In fact, we went to supper with somebody the other night, and they had Alexa, and they kept asking Alexa all these things and telling them to play sorts of music and getting cross when she got the wrong music.
Did they really?
No, Alexa, you fool. Go to your room. And then there was another thing they were saying, that people with cognitive impairments, so it makes them more independent by reminding them to take their medication.
Yes.
And also reminding them what medication they might have, they've taken already that day.
Yes.
And reminding people about hospital appointments or appointments with a GP.
Yeah.
So it's quite clever in a way.
Yes.
What's they say? Yeah, so they did a particular case how this woman, elderly woman, was very reliant on her daughter for all those things, and
by coincidence, her daughter was called Alexa.
Yes.
Alexa, have I got any baked beans in the cupboard?
I've told you. And so 3 months later, she could do all of the activities with Alexa's prompt. So there we are.
Yes. So basically, she never needs to see her daughter again.
No, that's
all
right.
She needs to do, that, I must admit, that is what crossed my mind when I read that.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And as I was saying to you earlier, it's kind of counterintuitive. There does seem to be an accumulating body of evidence that indicates that people get a kind of of amelioration of their isolation from interacting with a robot of some description.
Yes. Yeah.
And people accept it as being a form of social interaction.
Yes, that is true. Yes. Yeah.
And you think to yourself, well, that can't be right. You can't get the same benefits from talking to a digital assistant that you get from talking to a real human being.
Yes, yeah.
But there does seem to be some evidence that you do get a lot of the benefits, or at least some of the benefits.
Well, I think some of the benefits, according to whoever wrote this article, and they said about some, that already social prescribing is funded, and that seems to support people in especially in poorer economic circumstances. But they can't be sure that the health technology has that demonstrable, that's a tricky word to say,
yes.
Benefit. So,
although social prescribing is a bit, little bit.
Well, yes, I think there's probably, it's probably variable as well, isn't it? and then they said probably helps with mental health problems.
So it's kind of like the old telehealth idea,
yes,
isn't it?
But
it's,
yeah,
it's much more user-friendly. Well,
yes, it definitely is. It doesn't make you stand on scales and
yeah,
you know, and check your own blood pressure.
And you don't have to kind of learn how to work the buttons and things. All you have to do is talk to it.
I
don't know how people would set up reminders about their tablets and whether or not they'd taken their tablets that morning.
Yes.
Presumably you'd have to tell Alexa, Alexa,
well, yes, I've just taken my pink tablet.
Yes.
Yes. Alexa says, that's not yours, that's the dog's.
Yeah, right. Well, at least you won't have worms or distemper. So,
yeah, well, then the bit about the sort of, on the same sort of thing, having something to talk to,
yes,
that responds, tells them, in fact, or even tells them a bad joke. Well,
yeah.
Luckily, we don't know any bad jokes.
No, that's right. All of our jokes are terrific.
Yes, yes. And that was comforting.
Yes.
So I think you're right. There is a sort of interaction there, isn't it? It's an interactive thing.
Yeah.
Like you were saying about the television, is not really interactive.
Yeah, you're just sitting there watching
it. Watching football or cricket or something like that.
Unless you're my brother watching a political programme. No, that's not right. So Matt Hancock's rationale for this, I think, or
yes,
I say Matt Hancock,
yeah,
but you know, the Department,
yeah,
of Health,
yes,
or the government's rationale for this,
yeah,
is that,
yeah,
if people get more, A, independent,
yeah,
B, reliable healthcare advice,
yes,
in their own homes,
yes,
from,
yeah,
something which has got good medical,
yes,
information,
yeah,
in it.
Good information, yeah.
Then that will sort of, you know, prevent them from ringing the GP or maybe taking them off to A&E. So this,
yes,
is all,
yeah,
I mean, this is all part of a kind of a strategy,
yes,
designed to divert people's medical needs,
yes,
in other directions so they,
yes,
don't go to primary care or secondary,
yes,
care. So,
yeah,
so you can, so it's like seeking advice from your pharmacist instead,
yeah,
of going to the general practitioner,
yeah,
or going to 111 instead of,
yes,
going to 999,
yes,
or going online. It's all part of this kind of,
it
you
is,
know,
yeah.
Do you have to have an appointment with a doctor?
Yes.
Do you have,
yeah,
to take yourself,
yes,
off to accident and emergency?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
that's where the sort of the kind of straining points in the system are. The,
yeah,
fact that
yes,
the capacity is overloaded in A&E.
Well, that's true.
And it's,
yes,
overloaded in primary care,
well,
as
well.
Well,
that is partly what they're saying, a potential resource for primary health care. 300 million Great British pounds per year. Oh, I don't know what that means. That's nothing to do with us.
Sure. Well, that's how much we're,
yeah,
going to get
how
given.
Much it costs missed appointments.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
Mind
you, if you're,
yeah,
talking in millions of pounds,
yeah,
basically forget it. Unless it's billions, it's,
all
not,
right,
it's,
all
not
right,
real money,
right,
on a national scale.
Well, I won't talk about it. yeah, and managing, they think it might help with managing complex comorbidities.
Mm.
I'm not so sure about that, really.
But I think the elephant in the room,
yeah,
is that it's Amazon.
Yes.
And what,
yes,
Amazon do,
yeah,
is they take information,
yes, yes,
from people who,
yes,
interact with their services,
yes, yes,
and they store it all away in what,
yeah,
they call breadcrumbs and trails,
right,
of sort of, you know, this,
yes,
is a, this is a,
yeah,
pattern of behaviour,
yeah,
not just for that particular individual person,
yes,
but for vast numbers of people who interact with their services in certain ways,
yeah,
and they then use that,
yes,
to underlie their marketing strategies,
yes,
whereby they put things back to,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
and say, look, we've got these services,
yeah, yeah,
would you like to you know, would you,
yes,
like to buy this,
that
this
might
stuff?
Be,
so,
you might find
so
that very helpful,
yeah,
yes,
so you,
yeah,
you go onto Amazon and you,
yeah,
stick in a search saying that you're looking for, you know, a book by,
yeah,
Hilary Mantel,
yes,
let's,
yes,
say,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
next time you go on Amazon, you'll see all Hilary Mantel's other books,
yes, yeah,
being advertised to, mm, you, because it's got a memory of that search.
Mm.
you go on Amazon and you say, you know, you're interested in razor blades or something.
Yeah.
And next time you go on Amazon, you've got all kinds of male grooming appliances, aftershave, and goodness knows what, all over the place.
Yeah.
And not only on Amazon, but they can follow you around the internet as well, because Amazon do targeted ads on different sites too.
Right, yeah.
But
yeah.
And this is what, and but also Amazon are interested in getting into the health market. They're interested in getting into pharmaceuticals. Yeah. And online consultations and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, unless there are strict regulations about how they can store people's information and reuse it, this is going to put them over a period of years in a really powerful position to market their own services if they decide that they want to do that.
Yes.
So, to me, there are big alarm bells ringing when I hear this kind of stuff about, you know, we're going to... I mean, and I can see why the government might think it's a quick win. It makes people more independent.
Yes.
It stops them feeling so isolated. It'll maybe take some pressure off secondary services and primary care.
Yes, yes.
But there may be a big price to pay for it further down the line in terms of giving Amazon this terrific sort of foothold in the health marketplace.
Well, quite possibly.
And they will certainly know how to exploit that if they decide that they want to do that.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that, really.
And so be afraid.
Well, be very afraid, yes. but I think the one thing is, you know, there is a difference between communicating with, you know, a family member or rather than a machine.
You're coming back to the difference between her talking to her daughter and talking to Alexa.
Yes, yeah. But it is an unreal world in a way, apart from you can hear the sound and you're not communicating with another being in any way.
Yeah, well, as I say, your kind of instinct is that must be bad for you spiritually.
Well, yeah, to a degree.
We don't really know, I don't think.
No. But, you know, there's, you know, that thing in Neighbour's book, you know, in the heading in one of the chapters is only connect.
Mm.
And I don't think you can make the same sort of connection with something that is just mechanical and you can accidentally pull it out of the wall and it's dead. Would you? You wouldn't mourn it, really, would you? You'd just buy a new one. And I think, you know, I just think we get further and further away from, with modern technology, from nature and the world around us, and we lose the appreciation of that, and maybe some of the understandings that we had when we were running naked in the woods.
Speak for yourself, mate.
I had a very poor upbringing, you know.
Well, I think there's a difference between communicating with your daughter, who comes around and reminds you about your tablets, and communicating with nature. An old lady who's housebound might not have an awful lot of communication with nature.
That's true.
These are rather deep philosophical questions that perhaps we shouldn't get too bogged down in.
Yes, you're right. I think it's gone off the boil a bit.
I think that is another... you know, valid aspect of it. And I think that if our friend Hans was here, he would say that, you know, that it's surprising how much people will...
Well, that's true, yes.
...will communicate with a machine instead of a human being and endow it with all the sort of human traits that you might think that they wouldn't accept a machine as a substitute. Yes. But in fact, because you're so... keen to communicate with something else, and to endow it with those properties that you look for in something else that you want to communicate with.
Yeah,
all you need is kind of basic pattern, and you will start doing that.
Yeah, I think it probably is a bit like television, and you know, other sort of, you know, where you see pictures of people, and you know, you hear them speaking and moving and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
there must be a link there. And when television was invented, people thought that was the end of the world.
Well, that's true. People have always said, you know, looking at television isn't the same as reading a book.
No.
And, looking at a television isn't the same as looking at a film.
No.
And looking at a film isn't the same as going to the theatre.
Yes.
Playing a game online isn't as good as...
driving a car.
Or looking at the television.
No.
So, people always think that new technology might be worse for your brain than... the older technology, which was more intellectual and in some way rigorous.
Yes.
And it very often turns out not really to be the case when you investigate it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I think we'll leave this one and move on.
Medical,
yes,
really.
Otherwise we'll just end up hosting a philosophy podcast.
Yes.
Okay, so now let's move on to the ones about personalised risk-based cancer screening, you were particularly interested.
Yes,
So, do you want to...
Well, I could just whiz through it quite
quickly. Let's just give the reference for this, which is, it's in the BMJ, and it's called Personalised and Risk-Based Cancer Screening, and the reference is L5558. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's this is we briefly talked about it last time. I muscled in on it because I thought it was interesting.
Yes.
This is the first, risk-based cancer screening program there is. The previous one, was different from this, using fecal occult blood.
So what is this? What is this screening for that we're talking about?
Well, it's for breast
this...
cancer,
right?
And it's for people between the ages of 50 and 79, I think.
Right.
I've lost the piece of paper now, but it doesn't matter. And so basically, they do a risk calculation from the risk factors for.
You said it was for breast cancer.
This is for cancer. Yeah, no, not breast cancer.
Bowel
cancer. Yeah, colon cancer. So,
almost the same thing.
Yeah,
down the other end.
Yes, exactly.
Carry on.
And they calculate the 15-year risk of getting colon cancer, not breast cancer, of course.
Of course not.
And if it's greater than 3%, then they would recommend, one of the screening options, which is this FIT test, which is a fecal immuno something or other test.
Fecal immunochemical testing.
That's right.
FIT.
Yeah. Either once a year or once every 2 years, and apparently that has little or no effect on the incidence of colon cancer. But the 1 year one has, a very small reduction in incidence of cancer, and so the other things are having a sigmoidoscopy, which probably can increase reduce the mortality and incidence. But really, what they mean by reduced incidence, because that's the number of new cases per year, it's only doing that by picking up some adenomas at a stage where they haven't turned into anything nasty. So it is overall, but it's like it's a bit like cervical screening in a way, isn't it?
So the existing bowel cancer screening program is basically you get to a certain age.
Yes.
I think it must be 55.
Yeah.
It might be 60, because I've definitely had a kit through my door.
Yes, yeah.
And it says, send us back a poo sample and we'll do like an analysis. I think they've actually changed the way in which they collect them now, but the one that I had was send us back a poo sample, we'll do an analysis. And then if there seems to be anything in it, then we might progress to doing a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy or whatever the appropriate investigation is.
Yes.
But
the evidence for the previous one, the colorectal screening, was quite fragile, they say, in the BMJ.
Right.
And they belittled the possible harms and benefits of it. So they upped the... this is a good thing to have done.
Yeah.
So public health insurance overstated the benefits and understated the harms, which could be bowel perforation, things like that. So
right.
An infection. So, yeah, in a way, it's probably a wrong assumption. It's a politically based rather than evidence based.
Right.
So this is much more based on overall risk. But the problem with, one of the problems with it is that actually your risk of, as you know, in 5 years, so if you had a, you know, risk assessment at 50, in 5 years, there's probably an increase in risk. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was 0.5 to something or other percent. So a significant increase every 5 years.
Right.
So if you think you might be, you decide to have screening in at the age of 79,
right,
your risk of, you know, dying of colon cancer or getting colon cancer is, right, going to be very high anyway. So are you actually
what? So what you're saying life? Is if you think you're going to defer being screened,
yes,
until, yeah, later in your life,
yes,
then if it so happens that there is something going on,
yes,
your risk of that turning nasty and killing you could be much higher if you eventually get round to being screened at the age of 79 instead of if you've been screened at 60 or,
yes, or, yes,
or a much earlier age.
Yeah, so there's very little difference in all-cause mortality with this sort of screening.
Right.
But it does ask the question whether the calculation of risk is 100%, well, no, it's not 100% accurate, but, you know, could it not be very, very accurate?
Yeah.
But there is a Q cancer calculator.
Right.
So it's like a Q risk thing.
Mm.
The idea is you have, the people will have a consultation with a healthcare provider, probably a GP,
right,
or, you know, maybe practice nurse,
what, to decide whether they are in the category where screening is advised?
Yes, yes. Oh,
so, right, okay.
So if it's above 3%, then they would advise it. But then you negotiate that with the patient. So it gives patient choice.
Yes.
Whereas the other one was, oh, you'd better have this done or you're going to get cancer of the colon.
Yes.
So it's more ethical medicine, and we're supposed to be shared management plans. Well, and
I
so
mean,
on.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, there are two. I mean, there are two different sort of perspectives on this, aren't there? There's,
yeah,
the perspective of the individual patient,
yes,
and what's right for that individual patient.
Yes, yes.
And then there's the kind of big medicine perspective,
yeah,
which is, you know, we want to try to reduce the incidence of blah.
Yes.
Whatever it is. In the population at large,
yes,
and,
yeah,
the way to do that is to introduce, yes, a big screening, yes, program,
yes,
right the way across, yeah, the population.
But it's not, that's not common sense, really, because the incidence of blah really is the incidence of death.
Mm.
And no, you can't reduce the incidence of death.
Can't you?
Well, you can't. You can't. Surprisingly, you know, death is inevitable.
Is it?
Yeah, well, I believe so.
Well, it might be for you, mate.
Well, it definitely is for me. No chance there. It's sort of wrong thinking in a way, I think.
I'll be laughing. I'm sorry, my face, when I'm actually dead.
But it's, you know, it's like you can prevent everything, and of course you can't prevent everything.
Yeah.
And
but it's also, there's also an aspect of it to you know, the kind of one of the big things at the moment is the fact that cervical screening rates,
yes,
are going down.
Right.
And that's,
yes,
and that's a big kind of, you know, the uptake rates are getting lower.
Yes.
More and more people, yeah, are exposing themselves to the risk of having cervical cancer.
Yes.
And there's a big sort of public information. It gets into the news.
Yeah.
And the kind of whole sort of public information profile of that is,
yes,
screening is good for you.
Yes.
Rates need to go up, not down.
Yes, exactly.
Non-attendance to screening is bad.
Yes, exactly.
And what they're saying here is,
yeah,
okay, we're going to target it instead,
yes,
of saying, you know, everybody should have this screening.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to target at those,
yes,
people,
yeah,
who,
yeah,
are most at risk.
Yes.
And screening rates will go down.
Yes,
and,
yeah,
also we're going to give patients a chance to make a decision, and we're going to say to them, look, here,
yes,
are the risks, here,
yes,
are the benefits.
Yes, yeah.
So you make your mind up,
yes,
and And screening rates will go down as a result of that.
Yes, they probably will do, but at least people have made a choice.
Yeah.
Whereas,
so like I say, it's big population engineering as against what's right for the individual patient.
Yes, exactly.
These two different kind of views of, of medicine. Yes,
it is. Well, it's the same with, you know, you've got to have this vaccination.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to, but... You know, but the other thing with the giving people the choice, it might all that might depend on the health care provider that you see to discuss your risk.
Yes.
And
so is that how it's going to work?
Well, that's what they're saying. Right. Yes. So you had to use this calculator.
Right.
And then you talk to health care provider. Because
I was kind of imagining that what would happen is that you know that the people running the running the screening program would make this calculation and say, right, you're in the 3%, you're in the above 3% bracket, you better have it.
Yes.
But you think it's more
well, this
a question
is what
of,
it's saying in the article. I'm not sure how it's going to be sort of spread out around the country.
Right.
But one of the issues with that is if the healthcare care provider thinks, oh, screening is a good idea, you ought to have screening, and he says, well, you know, the screening, you know, you don't have to have the test done, but... you know what a neighbour would call gift wrapping. So you can give two options to people,
right?
And you can say, "Ooh, not sure about
this
that."
Is
but,
the classic.
You know, it's up to you. It's
when
really
you take your car in for an MOT,
yes.
Well, of course your carburettor.
Yeah.
It'd probably be all right for another year, but if it goes when you're on the way up the motorway, it's a call out charge, isn't it? Take a week, take off the road for a week at least, and.
Well, exactly.
So pay me 200 quid now, or you might have to pay 1,000 quid later on.
Well, precisely. So it's about the difference people, you know, what risk they're willing to accept, and also the values of the, you know, both the patient and the healthcare professional, really.
Yes.
And that's what we're supposed to
So if people
be
come
doing.
And see you, in other words, for advice about, should I have this screen? Oh, no, don't bother, it's not worth it. What's the point?
Yeah, well.
Somebody's fiddling around up your bumhole. You don't want that. Or is it like go and see somebody else and say, yes, you've got to have it. Otherwise you'll die.
When I say got to, I don't mean you got to, but you might need to consider it really, really seriously.
Yes.
So I think that's enough of that one because...
Okay.
Well, they do revisit the risk every 5 years. So,
right.
You know,
I suppose the aspect of that is that if somebody's gone through the process of making up their mind one way or the other when they were 65 and you come back to them when they're 70, do you think that because they've made up their mind, oh, no, I don't think I'll bother with the screening when they're 65?
Yes.
How flexible do you think people are going to be? Do you think, well, I made a decision about that when I was 65, that's my decision. I'm going
well,
to stick by
I think
that.
It does. It does depend on this. You know, the increase is 0.5% to 1.5% increase in risk every 5 years. So if you had
so
it
that
done,
would change the advice.
Yeah.
To that
so if you had it done when you were 50,
right.
The average risk is somewhere between 1% and 2%. So you wouldn't be very likely to be in the risk group. But if you added another 1.5% on.
So it's
like
advice about statins and things in a way,
you're already
in
the 3.5% risk, and they're going to say, well, you should have, say, 55.
Yeah.
They're going to advise it, or it's going to be advised. But if you're 60 or 65, you're going to be much higher. You're definitely well in above 3.5%.
Sure, that's so old once you get to the age of 60.
No, dreadful thought.
Every orifice should be probed.
Yes. Luckily, I've forgotten how to think. No, so it's all right.
All right, well, I think we've probably done about an hour's worth.
So
we've only got through a few of the things that we actually had to discuss.
But we had a bit of a laugh anyway.
A bit of a laugh. Yes, so that's really what it's all about.
Yes,
so thank you very much, everybody, for listening.
Yes,
and we'll be back same time next month.
Hooray.